Happy Cinco de Mayo, everyone. Hopefully you're not too mad at us for waiting an extra day. Because we had the day off today in terms of games, we figured it made more sense to get two games under our belt in each of the series and to have a podcast that could actually marinate for more than a day and still actually be worthwhile. So how are you enjoying the second round so far?
It's been pretty good. I think we have two great series being played on the one night, and then we kind of exhale a little bit on the other night, and it's maybe not quite as competitive, although we'll see. I mean, we've seen so many series turn when the venue shifts, so when these series get to Dallas and get to Philadelphia, and especially if Embiid plays, they could go in a very different direction still.
I thought Dallas and Phoenix was going to be a really good series, and Phoenix has just absolutely destroyed them so far. I mean, and the Suns being up 2-0, I mean, I'm not just like shocked by that, but just the way that they've done it and the way that Dallas was able to actually really shut down a Utah offense that ranked higher than Phoenix in the regular season and just has no chance against this Phoenix team. What do you make of that?
That second half last night, the targeting Luka as he ran out of gas, that was one of the most savage things I've ever seen. I mean, when Jay Crowder is going right by him off the dribble.
And yeah, they started with Jay Crowder, and then they're like, oh, well, actually, maybe we'll have Chris Paul do it now.
Yeah. But the fact that Dallas was hiding him, trying to hide him on the fourth and fifth option, and Phoenix just kept finding him and kept finding him. They were just so relentless. It was, you know, it was one of those scenes where you're like, stop, he's already dead, you know? And
oh, man.
It was just vicious. It was the coldest thing I've seen. And, you know, usually something happens like that in a playoff game, and the coach calls timeout and takes the guy out of the game when somebody's being targeted like that. But when it's your best player, you're not going to call timeout and take him out of the game. So it was almost reminiscent of, I guess the closest thing is when Reggie Jackson just kept going by the Clipper guards in game six last year.
Or the Jazz guards, yeah.
I'm sorry, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, it was just savage. It was incredible to watch.
Well, especially because it was just so intentional. And that's what Chris Paul is. He's just an assassin. He knows what he wants to do every single time. And I think as badly as he killed the New Orleans Pelicans, like Herb Jones and Jose Alvarado actually like pressured up and at least sped him up a little bit, or said, had him say, hey, let's bring the ball up, give the ball to somebody else to bring it up, which I realize they do a lot of times to save his energy. But, you know, at least they're making it hard for him to get the ball back and just exerting some pressure. And they're just not doing that. Now, I think this is the biggest thing I wanted to talk to you about from this series. And these are related things. And ESPN Stats and Info had this, that basically Luka was targeted more and more efficiently as a screen defender than basically anyone in any game over like the X number of years that they have tracking for. I can't remember the exact stat. I'll find it while you're talking. But, and then they're shooting 61% on twos outside of the paint for the playoffs. And so, yeah, like you're going to look really awesome when you're doing that. And they are, I mean, one of the few, maybe the Nets would be the only other team that you'd think of could go on this kind of a run.
Yeah.
But those two things, I mean, those are just massive outliers, right? Like they can't fully sustain, right?
I don't think so. I mean, we've seen this movie before with Luka where because we saw in the Clipper series last year, they weren't quite as intentional targeting him, but where he ran out of gas as the game went on, because the first half, it's he's so good that it actually creates a little bit of a problem, because why wouldn't you just run every single play through him? But then he doesn't have the stamina to do that for 48 minutes in a playoff game. And so Dallas needs to either get him off the ball more or be smarter about how they substitute him or do something differently so that we don't just see this movie again and again. We're like, hey, Luka had 24 in the first half. That's great. And he finishes with like 31 and 6 turnovers.
Yeah. And I mean, is there anyone who ever has been able to be successful running every single play through them for this long? I mean, maybe you could say LeBron in 2015 and 2018, but that would LeBron be, James, yeah.
Yeah, you're asking him to be prime LeBron James, basically. And yeah, he's improved his conditioning, but it's just not at that level, and you can see it. And the every other day format of this is going to be pretty unforgiving for him on that too, especially, again, the Suns were assassins. That we're going to make him defend on every single play. and it was like a video game where you just see the fighter's hit points going down and down and down, right? Like, he couldn't even get in a stance.
Yeah, I mean, on the ball. Like, it's, you know, if you're James Harden or you're Trae Young, and you, well, Trae Young doesn't get in a stance on the ball either, but but still, you've got a Hall of Fame point guard going right at you, and you're just standing straight up and just trying to almost like move your controller around. And it, like, that's kind of what he looked like, right? He looked like one of those early video games when they couldn't actually animate the guy getting into a defensive stance yet. So if you're trying to play defense, like, the guy would just kind of run in a direction when you move the controller to try and play defense and stay in front of someone. Like, that's what he looked like at this point. Like, shout out Bulls versus Blazers.
Yes, exactly. That's the exact game I was thinking of. That's perfect.
It was Lakers versus Celtics was the first one of those where Tom Chambers could just run to basically one step inside the three-point line on the top of the screen. You'd hit the shoot button, and he'd do the double pump dunk over Mark Jackson and just dunk it every single time. And it was just, if he got to that spot and you hit the shoot button, it was just a flying 22-foot dunk.
Yeah. I love the little quirks in those games used to have. We had one, I think it was for Nintendo, where, like, I think they coded something wrong, but do you remember David Benoit, who was like a backup forward for Utah? They made him into Superman, basically. Like, he was the best player in the whole thing.
But in any event, so I guess that my first question to you is this: Phoenix mid-range shooting, like, is this, they've shot now the second longest streak of shooting over 50% in NBA playoff history, I believe is the stat that I saw, and they're scoring just incredibly. They had the second highest true shooting percentage in a game in the NBA playoffs in this last game, highest ever outside of the bubble. The highest actually occurred against a very similar Mavs roster by the Clippers in game 5 in 2020. So what is this going to change? Like, can Phoenix keep making these shots? Because they're not like the easiest shots in the world necessarily.
Well, I mean, clearly, objectively. Chris Paul is on a crazy heater right now, but he shot 55% on non-paint twos in the regular season. So, like, this isn't a crazy outlier for him. Game 6 against New Orleans, he shot 14 for 14 without any layups. So he's capable of doing this. And then some of these mid-range numbers too are Ayton on switches, which are fairly easy shots for him.
Yeah, or just like quick pick and pop type of plays as well, where I used to criticize him for, like, why are you just like hot potatoing the ball out of your hands on these? But no, actually, if he makes like over 50% of these shots from mid-range, it probably actually is a good shot for him. You know, yeah. He reminds me of, as a quick aside, he kind of reminds me of like a 7-foot tall Anton Jameson the way he's playing right now.
Oh, that's interesting. Comparison? I was actually going to go with an in shape Kevin Duckworth.
Man, yeah, Kevin Duckworth had that very interesting. That I jump do kind shot. Of miss those yeah. days when guys just had crazy jump shots because they didn't look at YouTube videos to find out how you're actually supposed to shoot. And by the time they got to like real coaching, they just shot the ball the way they did, and it went in, and so nobody messed with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no more like Bill Cartwright or Jamal Wilkes these days. But in any event, this team looks amazing. And yeah, like, you could say the shooting is an outlier, but what isn't going to change is that you still have to guard that area so intensely in a way that you don't necessarily for other teams. And just seeing what this Phoenix team is doing to what was a good Dallas defense, although I will note that it got a lot worse once Luka came back.
Yes.
It's still pretty incredible. Dallas was good on defense during the regular season. They really throttled Utah quite a bit, who's supposed to be this great offense. And now they're just getting run out of the gym.
I am surprised, not that Utah is up 2-0, but by the apparent disparity between these two teams in the first two games. Like, it just feels easy for Phoenix right now.
Yeah. By the way, that stat, Kirk Goolsbury had this 1.81 points per chance when Doncic was the screener in the second half, the highest efficiency allowed by a single defender in any half over the last three seasons, minimum 15 direct picks, and he was on 19 on-ball screens. So that stat is going to be it's pretty remarkable, because anyone who's targeted for 15 direct picks, they're probably doing it because the guy's not any good.
Yeah.
And so,
I believe actually one of the misses also, because I was watching the fourth quarter again, one of the misses was a wide open three pointer for Cameron Johnson when he just like ran up and slipped the screen and Doncic just ended up like 20 feet behind the play.
It's funny because Luka normally isn't this bad, and he started off the season bad because he wasn't in shape. And then I thought he really improved. He was a big part of their defensive improvement. Even last year against the Clippers, they didn't really target him that much. And certainly the Clippers don't have as many fast guys. You know, Luka is better in kind of more strength matchups, but they didn't really go at him that much. I thought he held up reasonably well. Now, you could argue maybe they should have gone after him more because it would have tired him out as well. But I think maybe just the calf injury, he kind of got out of shape a little bit. Like, your calf shouldn't really affect you that much on defensive slides, like physically. But I think he's just not in the same type of condition that he was before that injury. That's the only thing I could point to, because do you agree that he actually, you know, he wasn't like a Trey or a James Harden type of guy?
Yes, I do agree with you. And it's interesting because I think when he came out into the league, a lot of people thought that's what he would be on defense, and he hasn't been that. But I think Phoenix almost stumbled into this. Like, I think the original idea for Phoenix is, let's wear this guy out so he stops killing us at the other end. And then it started working so well, it was like, oh my God, like, let's go after him every play.
Well, the Jazz actually had success against him, I thought, as well in the last round. And they weren't actually switching with him early in that round. Like, games 4 and 6, I thought they had some pretty good success against Luka. It's just their offense overall wasn't good enough. They didn't have this mid-range. Their ISO and mid-range guys just aren't as good as Phoenix. So what can they do now? How are they going to save this?
I think they have to think about how to manage Luka during the course of a game. Because the first half, he was awesome. And just he just ran out of gas. And so you can't just play him the whole first half and run every play through him and expect him to make it through 40-plus minutes at this intensity. They can also be smarter about how they do some things. Like, Dallas wasn't pre-switching off the ball to get him out of action either, which I would have expected them to do, especially with the players they had on the floor. Like, if you have Luka guarding their five anyway, like, just pre-switch that. Like, it's Biombo. Like, he was in for a lot of those possessions because Ayton had fouls. It's like, you just pre-switch that and you can get Luka out of the play. But they weren't doing that. And there's a reluctance to try zone against Phoenix, which I understand, but I was a little surprised they didn't at least try that.
Yeah, they haven't really been a zone team. I think they just don't necessarily have the cohesiveness to go to that at this point in the season. And they don't have really a lot of length. I mean, they're largely built on denying penetration to begin with. And I mean, maybe they could try the zone. I don't know how well that's going to work. I mean, Phoenix doesn't have a traditional type of playmaker. I mean, I guess you can get Ayton to the foul line and then he's going to just shoot it there. You hope that someone's there to bother him a little bit. So yeah, I think you can do that as a changeup. I don't know that there's any one solution. Like, the pre-switching. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead on the pre-switching.
I was going to say, I mean, I think, yeah, you definitely should try some of that. But eventually, Chris Paul, at least in the key moments of the game, is going to figure out how to get that guy up there. And a lot of what they're doing, too, is doing stuff off the ball early on, really, where they're setting a screen for Devin Booker on a pin down out of the corner with Luka's man, that sort of stuff, where you can't really, if it's starting off the ball, you can't really do that necessarily.
Yeah.
And Phoenix, Zach Lowe's talked about this extensively. They have a pretty good, well-disguised pick and roll game. They get into stuff. They move off the ball. It's not just as station to station as, say, Dallas's offense is.
I lost my train of thought.
Well, so yeah, you're going to say
the,
something.
The other thing, I know what I was going to say, because they also tried switch and double, which basically okay, we'll do the switch, but then we'll run another guy at you. And the problem is Phoenix's secondary guys are so good that it's really hard to do that against them. Like, they just ping the ball around and got a Biombo dunk right away.
Yeah. So to me, I think obviously you try to pre-switch when you can. I mean, the other problem with the pre-switch, though, is, okay, what if you just have Devin Booker's man screen Doncic's man initially, right? Or then you're starting off with Doncic on like Jay Crowder and the least threatening guy, and then if you pre-switch him, now Luka's on someone who's better, and so that's a problem, right? So I mean, the biggest thing that to me is so impressive about Phoenix on both ends is just, what is their weakness, right? You really struggle. They don't have the Donovan Mitchell that Dallas can go at with Jalen Brunson, other than Campaign, who maybe plays 10 minutes a game at this point. So I think that my approach would be just, you got to do a bunch of things, and it's tough to do a bunch of little things. It's much easier to do one big thing. But number one, I think they got to find a way to make Phoenix play later into the shot clock. And that's pressuring up Chris Paul full court some more, or if it's not Chris Paul, it's somebody else who's not going to be like some unbelievable dribbler. So like, put some pressure on him. Now that's tough because they don't have Jose Alvarado and Herb Jones on this team. They don't have that level of depth, but not even to force turnovers, but just to say, all right, we're going to let you play 2 or 3 seconds later in the shot clock than you normally would. And then if you're doing some pre-switching, then they've got less time to hunt that matchup, and then less time to make the play once they finally found the matchup. Like that part matters. You can also change up what you're doing, obviously, like do like the switch double sometimes. But again, if you do that, then they have less time to work with in theory. Maybe you do go zone every once in a while just to, again, kind of change it up, not give them the same look every time. And then I think the other thing is just, I mean, Luka Doncic said it after the game. He acknowledged like he just individually needs to be better. So they got to find ways to preserve his energy. Like, you've got Spencer Dinwiddie and Jalen Brunson on this team. You got to find a way to get them to be effective on the offensive end. Also, it would help to actually get some transition yourselves, so that would help Luka not have to make every single play on the offensive end. So I mean, I've got some ideas on how to do that as well on offense, but it's there's just a lot of, gonna have to be a lot of components to it. Like, you can't just fix it with just one snap of the fingers as a coaching
staff. Yeah, I mean, shout out Seth Partnow. The play better adjustment is always the biggest one, and Luka has to play better is the biggest one. I just think tactically there are some things that Dallas could do to help him play better in terms of managing his workload during the course of a game, so he has more left in the tank in the second half.
Sure. Well, what are some of those things?
Well, like you said, I mean, I think Brunson and Dinwiddie have to be more involved early, and they can't just settle into this thing. Well, we'll run pick and roll through Luka every play in the first half because he makes it look so easy that why wouldn't you do that? Well, you need him for the second half though, so you know he can't do that for 40 minutes. So you got to pick your spots a little better about when you're going to go to the whip on that. And I also think they might have to be comfortable with the idea of him playing like 34 minutes instead of 42.
Yeah, or maybe 38. 34 seems, I don't think they can win that way, but they can't win. I don't care if he's the greatest offensive player in NBA history, and he's probably close to that. If he's getting worked like this defensively, like, you're just not going to win no matter how good he is. So the feeling of, hey, we just can't live without him. Well, we know that this doesn't work, and particularly with him coming off the calf injury, and I think not in like the absolute peak of condition that he was in. But what do you think of this adjustment? I was thinking, when Payne comes in, take Luka out and then try to go for the particularly because JaVale is often in as well, so I think you can run decent conventional pick and roll at JaVale. Take Luka out and have Dinwiddie and Brunson in there, but also go to the five out with that group as well, and just say, all right, if we're that worried about Luka, when he's out of the game, we're going to actually maximize our chance of being successful. And when we're going to have to get some minutes out of Dwight Powell, but if we have Powell in without Luka, then we can't score. So we might as well just go with Luka and Powell together. Luka likes to have a pick and roll guy, and just say and feel like we're just in better shape, because Campaign is going to play at least some. Like, they're not going to play Chris Paul 43 minutes a game. No. So try to target him. He's the one guy you can target, and he and JaVale, and actually score reasonably well when Luka's off, and that can be a way to steal Luka's more time.
I think that's their best shot. I mean, they might be drawing dead no matter what, but
sure. Well, and they're down 2-0. That's even bigger than even if they can't play it or not. So what would you say as we go into games 3 and 4, what percent chance do you give Dallas of winning the individual games, either of these two games?
I think there's a decent chance they get one of them.
Yeah.
Right? You'd probably put them somewhere between 40 and 50% each game, maybe. Is that too optimistic?
Oh, I don't think so. I think like right around 50%. I mean, that's usually what it is in these series that go end up being gentlemen sweep, right? Like even the team that loses 4-1 has a 50% chance of winning their own home games. And sometimes they get it to 4-2 and or to 2-2 and end up being a 4-2 series or something like that. But yeah, I don't think my Phoenix and 7 pick is looking particularly good, but maybe Dallas will be a different team at home. As you said, things can change there. Anything else on this series, or shall we?
Let's move along.
Okay, where do you want to go next?
Should we talk about the war? Boston, Milwaukee.
Yeah, I thought that people were way too quick to bury Boston in game one, just because they, I mean, I don't think that they're going to play good offense in the series. And you saw the type of shooting performance it took for them to play good offense in game two. I don't think that's going to continue either.
Yeah.
But there were just a few things, like their transition offense just being so atrocious in a way that you wouldn't expect to continue. The fact that they didn't make a single two outside of the restricted area. And I thought they did a nice job of actually changing their approach. And I think they were 0 of 3 on twos outside the paint in game one, and 4 of 7 just in the first quarter on twos outside the paint in game two, because you've got to make this Milwaukee Bucks team guard the whole court. And their defense is good enough to me that just being able to not absolutely suck on offense, like if you can just get a decent mid-range shot, like you should just take it and then just trust that your defense will be good enough on the other end.
Yeah, I thought both games were outliers to some respect, but the aggregate is not. Like, this is going to be a defensive series, and it's going to hinge a lot on shot making from night to night. But I also think Boston has some advantages here that may play out as the series wears on. Like, they're just a deeper team. Even though they're not crazy deep, they have more quality to put in a game than Milwaukee does, especially with Middleton being out. They can match Giannis's physicality with a lot of their matchups. I thought Grant Williams was fantastic in game two. They have other players that can defend on him, that can switch on him and not be complete dead meat. And I think that's really important. And like you keep saying, like, Milwaukee cannot run a pick and roll. Like, it was crazy watching that first quarter where they just degenerated into Jrue Holiday trying to score against a switch, and which is like sort of might get you halfway okay offense sometimes, and Giannis taking jump shots. And that's just not any kind of formula for extended success for Milwaukee. It got better for them in the second half. They found some things, but I was Boston in seven before this started. I still think this is a long, physical, drawn out series, but I still think it's advantage Boston after the two games.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. And it's funny. I mean, there have been already probably like 5 or 6, it seems like, strategic phases to this series. And as soon as the adjustment gets made for one team, it's like you feel like the other team is just so incredibly hopeless and they're never going to score again.
Yeah.
That's just kind of the quality of these defenses, where Giannis is going 1 out of 10, doesn't get anything at the rim in the first half of game two. You mentioned what they did in the first quarter. Second quarter, they're like, all right, we're going to try to hand off with Giannis a lot, try to get him into like side pick and rolls. And they got a couple of decent plays there, but then it turns out that they're handing off to like Wes Matthews and Grayson Allen a lot of the time. And then Boston brought over someone to be off of one of Milwaukee's other guys who weren't really much of a threat, to just the big on the opposite side, to just stand under the rim to prevent that guard from driving so that the guy guarding Giannis could stay with Giannis. And then in the third quarter, the Bucks actually seemed to realize, okay, they're actually just playing Giannis one-on-one here with limited help. So Giannis just go score. And Giannis had a monster second half, and was taking a bunch of shots at the rim and actually scoring pretty well against these guys. But then Milwaukee still didn't get anything. Three-pointers. They made 3 three-pointers and they shot 18. When did you ever think a Mike Budenholzer Bucks team would get up 18 three-pointers in a game?
It's a real testament to the job Boston does, like how they can hold their own. Each of their guys can hold their own in a matchup, so there's no real attack point. Like we talked about, the contrasted with Phoenix hunting Luka every play. Like, who are you hunting on this Boston team? Like, unless Pritchard gets a cameo, and he's usually in against second units, like, what, you're going to hunt him with Javon Carter? There's just nowhere to go where you feel like there's an advantage.
Yeah, and that's why I think ultimately the possession game and transition is going to be where this ends up being decided. Certainly shooting luck will be part of it as well, right? Boston shooting a crazy percentage from three. I can't remember what they were in the first half, but they finished 20 out of 43. They're over 50%, I believe, from three in the first half of that game. I do think Milwaukee has to figure out a way to get some more threes. I mean, Giannis had the 12 assists in game one. He had 7 in game two. They had 16 assists on 34 field field goals, and they could shoot a little bit better from 3-2, but I mean, that 18 number, I mean, that is like, you know, 92 offensive rating game. Even if Giannis is going well, they still are going to have to figure out a way to get more three-pointers up than that. So I'm just wondering what the next evolution is going to be here. If they continue to play Giannis one-on-one, is he going to be able to just kill that so bad that then they have to help more and it opens up the three-point line more? I'm curious to see what that's going to look like. And maybe they'll just, because they're not helping as much, there won't be as much pressure. They don't get as many turnovers. Bucks can set their defense as well. Boston also, I think, kind of figured out that, hey, you know what, if we're not just slamming headlong into the paint on every possession, then we can avoid turning it over. They only had 11 turnovers, so that really helped stop the Milwaukee transition game. They only had 6 fast break points. I think Milwaukee really is the team that has to respond strategically. Do you see anything that they can kind of do? I mean, it's not going to be personnel based. These teams kind of have their rotations, I think.
Yeah, they both have who they have out there, and there's not really, they have some ability with their fourth quarter five, but otherwise, like, these are the 7 guys they're playing the whole series, and that's just going to be it. But Boston getting Marcus Smart back would help, obviously. It would extend their rotation to 8 then. But either way, I don't think Marcus Smart changes a lot tactically for Boston. I like, we could really get a game 5 that's like 78-74, right?
Yeah.
Like the way this is going, like they could just drag each other so far in the mud. I do think there are more things for Boston to potentially exploit, like, especially with this big starting lineup and Portis and Lopez playing next to each other. I do think that's one of the reasons that all that driving and kicking early in the game worked so well. Just because there just wasn't enough speed out there to cover everything on the perimeter and rotate the way they needed to. So, and then they have other advantages they can go to. If you force Milwaukee to stay small and you have Connaughton and Allen out there, and one of them has to play against one of Boston's better players, there's fewer places for him to hide. You can get some stuff that's profitable.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there are more holes in this Bucks defense, even if they do have that incredible size at the rim. If they're still dead set on putting 2 on the ball with Bobby Portis on every pick and roll that he's involved in, that can get the blender going a little bit for Boston out of that. Jason Tatum, the fact that they still feel like they need to bring someone up to the level of the ball on his pick and rolls so he doesn't take a 3, that's massive as well. Jaylen Brown, if he can get enough ISO game in the mid-range against some of their weaker defenders, that's a place that they can go.
Where he had really cooking against Grayson Allen last game. I mean, anytime they got that matchup.
Yeah. So, and now Jaylen's health is potentially a concern. I thought he definitely wore down it in the second half and seemed to be bothered by the hamstring. We'll see if the 3 days off can really help him or not. But it does seem Boston has just a few more scabs to pick at than Milwaukee does, and that Milwaukee has these incredible strengths with their defense, but that you can kind of learn to play against that a little bit more. But there's still, you know, Milwaukee is still making it difficult for them, right? Like, if they don't have this incredible shooting performance, and they went 20 of 43 from downtown, they had a big hot streak late when it seemed like the Bucks might get back into contact to push it away again. But I didn't think that they still were only 49% from 2 with really good mid-range shooting. I didn't think that their second half offense was like so awesome or anything like that either for Boston.
Not at all.
Anything else you wanted to talk about for this series?
Are they playing for the championship?
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
No,
yeah, I can't quite get there either. I'm really excited for this series, but I can't quite get to that. I went, like, Boston's first half was championship caliber to me, and not just because of the shooting. But there's a difference between that and saying this is the series for the championship. I can't get there either. I just wanted to ask.
Well, and it really is fascinating. Now, I think you can call Phoenix a two-way team. And, you know, Memphis might be heard from too. We'll talk about that series in a second. But we're kind of going back to the old school where the West is the offense conference and the East is the defense conference. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think Miami is absolutely going to be heard from. Like, they're going to have home court advantage. Their defense can be just as good as either of these other defenses, I would say. And, you know, I don't think we're going to spend that much time talking Philly and Miami, but I don't think Philly's going to be able to make it through at this point with the state of Embiid. But no, I think I mean, I think either one of these teams could win the championship. Although Milwaukee, I don't know. I don't think they could beat whoever comes out of the West unless Middleton is like really back and playing well, which I just don't seems pretty unlikely for me if he really has a grade two MCL. And what do you make of this Golden State Memphis series?
There's been stuff happening, huh? It's been eventful, right? Interesting because I think both teams can feel like they should be up 2-0. Golden State, I thought, had control of game two, and tactically they just let Ja Morant beat them in the fourth quarter and made it too easy for that to happen. And Memphis, on the other hand, has to look at game one and say, we're at home, Draymond Green's kicked out of the game, that's the one we have to get. And they did not get that one. And they blew the 2-for-1 toward the end of that. They got it in game two, and that was a real key, that bucket. And so, but both these teams are kind of sizing each other up still a little. I still feel like it's advantage Golden State. I said Golden State in seven, I think, when we did our playoff preview at the beginning. I would still probably go that way. I presume Dylan Brooks will be suspended for game three, which would put Memphis at a disadvantage. They don't have their prime Curry defender right from the tip, and Golden State can strategize for that. Although they're not a team that typically picks at weaknesses. Like, you'll never see Golden State do what Phoenix did to Luka last night, right?
Yeah. Although they also don't quite have that type of personnel either.
Yeah, true. And you see it even with Ja Morant, though. Like, there are more places for him to hide at some levels. On other levels, there's not, because there's three guards and he has to guard one of them, and it's a problem. You could say, like, he's been exposed a little on defense in these playoffs, as good as he's been on offense. But I'm interested, because you follow Golden State more closely than I have all year. I'm interested to see what your take is on these first two games.
Yeah, I've been, after winning game one, I think you could feel better about Golden State. Obviously, that loss in game two is rough. 7-38 3-point shooting, basically the worst 3-point shooting game of the Kerr era.
Yeah.
So you don't want to overreact to that necessarily. They clearly have a Ja Morant problem. I was extremely critical of the strategy, even more so than you, which we don't need to get into too much. But basically, A, don't let him go left every time. Like, you don't have to, like, give him the right, but at least influence right. Because yes, when he goes left, he wants to finish left, or he can spin back right. When he goes right, really, it's more often just the righty floater. And he's just more comfortable pushing off, I think, with his right leg to make an explosive move to his left. Like, that's something he's going to actually need to improve. I mean, if you go back and look at the film, pretty much every one of those buckets, he starts off going left. And yeah, he might make a spin move going back to his right, but it's not like you're going to just stop him that way, but at least start off having the scouting report. This, oh yeah, we're just going to let him shoot. Okay, number one, if you actually look at what he shoots on wide open threes, like, that's not a great idea. And like, yeah, you know, he's an NBA player, and he's a good NBA player. Like, we're not talking about TJ McConnell here from the top of the key. And maybe it's, oh yeah, you know, we let him shoot and it'll just cut off his passing game. Well, number one, I mean, people don't understand how incredibly depleted Memphis was at the end of that game, right?
I mean, that was the thing. So you had like Desmond Bane running on fumes. You had Brooks out of the game. You had Jackson out of the game. And so if you were ever going to run doubles at Ja, like, why? That's the time, right? Like, there's no shot creation on the floor outside of Ja.
Yeah, or maybe not let the guy who's shooting over 40% for the series now and looks very comfortable taking them just take a wide open three, you know, at least like make him drive and help, right? Like, it's Ja Morant. He's a second team all NBA player. You have to be, oh, just let him shoot. Like, that's your strategy. Like, no, he's too good for that. You need to, or hey, we'll back off of him so that he can just get a running start into the lane every time. Like, actually put a good defender on him, defend him like a normal player, make him go the direction most of the time that you want to go. And then, because, all right, you might say, hey, we've got our help winning in the lane. But if he just has no pressure on him and can just attack at absolute full speed and can read the floor with no pressure at all, right? Like, it's going to be so much easier for him to make a play once he gets in there. Like, if you actually have someone close to him, and yeah, he might be able to get by that guy a little easier, but now you're sending him a certain direction. You've got help there. It's not just he can read what's going on so easily. Yeah. So, like, yeah, actually, like, play real defense. This is one of the best guards in the NBA. You're not going to win the series by just let him shoot.
Yeah. Some of those horn sets, like, it was almost comical. Like, his defender was below both elbows, right? Just letting him walk into it.
Yeah. I mean, he shot 34% from three, and he's taking a lot of difficult off-the-dribble attempts. Like, you just let him shoot. He's going to make enough of him. He's 9 out of 23 on this series.
Yeah.
So that's obviously a problem. Now, not having Gary Payton the second is going to hurt some. The other thing they need to do is Jordan Poole is, as you like to say, sponsored by Target in the playoffs. And Denver figured that out by the end of their series with their very limited guards. And now it's John Morant. I mean, Jordan Poole looked about as bad as you will ever see anyone look on one of those drives where he just fell down, tried to get up, and fell down again, trying to get up with his back to Jaws.
He was facing the wrong way as his legs gave out. Yes, that was pretty astounding. Like, how do you end up in that position as a defender?
that was pretty remarkable. So but again, how about you put two on the ball, or you say we're gonna hedge with Jordan Poole, and all right, you want to get a pick and pop to Zaire Williams or whoever Jordan Poole is guarding, okay, do that, or we'll rotate out of that as well, given how limited they were. Now I think for Memphis, if Bain can get these 3 days off and come back and be Desmond Bain again, I think Golden State could actually be in some trouble in this series, because you're starting to see it, particularly with Melton. They're forcing turnovers. Draymond and Steph have had these bad turnovers. Draymond really has been pretty ineffective in the series. Maybe part of that was he couldn't see out of his right eye very well in game two. Mm-hmm. But I think just overall for Golden State, even if they can make it through here, I'm not sure how sustainable this Steph, Clay, Poole lineup is to close games. I think the hope was that they would just be so unbelievable offensively that it wouldn't matter that their defense wasn't any good. But going against a team that's not Denver, I think that offense might be worse on defense than it is good on offense against like a real team, mm-hmm. like Phoenix, for example. We see what is Phoenix going to do to Jordan Poole. We've seen what they've done to Doncic. So, and maybe having Gary Payton the second out there, I thought was actually maybe the best closing lineup for Steve Kerr in game one. And now Gary Payton the second got taken out by a dirty play. He's going to be out for a month potentially. So maybe Poole has to play. Maybe getting Iguodala back would help. And then the other thing I'll say this too, John, I just don't think Steph Curry is that guy. Like, he may prove me wrong, and he is coming off an injury, but we saw it during the regular season as well. Like, if you had last year's Steph Curry, I'd feel a lot better about them. Like, last year's Steph Curry would have been the best player in the series. John Morant is the best player in the series. That's not great for Golden State.
Yeah. What do you think about what Memphis is doing defensively? Because it seems like they're pretty committed to playing a switching lineups. They hedged a little with Tillman, I guess, right? Yeah. But I wonder about that as far as Steven Adams ever reappearing in this series.
Yeah, Golden State would love it if he came back.
Because the one thing with what Memphis is doing right now is they're pretty small, and especially when once Jackson picks up his third foul or fourth foul or whatever, and they have to play, then they're playing Clark at five and either Zaire Williams or Dylan Brooks or whoever at four. Zaire Williams might start next game, actually, as I think about it. That's a small team, and there are things that maybe Golden State can attack. They're not really a post-up team, but I do wonder if they could play through Wiggins more against some of those lineups.
Yeah, and I'd like to see more of Kuminga as well. I thought he played well in game two, and Memphis is not some veteran team that's going to take advantage of his inexperience nearly as much, and he actually has some confidence finishing at the rim against Memphis's athleticism. Like, Jaren Jackson, while he did foul out on his usual array of stupid fouls in the second half, he put a rim on the lid or a lid on the rim for Golden State throughout a lot of the game when he was in, and I thought they really were kind of scared to go up, and Kuminga just gives them that option of like, oh, okay, like they're not going to go to it every time, obviously, but if there's a scramble situation and he has a smaller player, he's actually very comfortable just working inside and just finishing, even in a way I would say that Wiggins isn't. Clay, obviously, like, he isn't either. By the way, I would put John Morant on Clay if they're going to go with those three guards, and you have to put John one of them. I would absolutely put him on Clay and just because Clay is, he's going to shoot, but he's not going to move that much off the ball. His post-ups are always going to result in mid-rangers because he's just not willing to like be physical enough to just back down.
He took some bad shots in game two, man.
Oof. Yeah. And so, you know, Steph and Clay and Poole, they were 29 from three. That's going to change. But I did think that there was a much lower quality of their shots throughout a lot of the game from three. And they were just missing bad too, even on some of the decent looks. So maybe that'll just change. I mean, I do think I'll probably stick with my Golden State in six prediction, but I'm feeling much worse about Golden State, particularly now with Peyton out, going up against Phoenix. I think if I had to pick that series today, I would pick Phoenix to win comfortably.
I just think, like, I still think there are tactics available to Golden State where they could come pretty close to shutting down this Memphis offense, and they didn't take advantage of those tactics in game two, or really that much in game one either. But the fact that those are still available and they can go to those, like, I'm still thinking at some point they do that stuff, and that tilts things in this series.
Yeah, but then they may have missed their chance if Bane is actually back and the Memphis has some other players that can hurt you from the outside. But yeah, I think I'm fascinated to see how Golden State comes out. Like, are they actually going to come out and just be throwing the ball all over the gym and giving up a bunch of fast break points to Memphis and letting their athleticism tell? Are they going to just be a little bit more intentional and just, because they have the talent advantage. Like, it's not even close, you would think, going forward in terms of just the offensive skill level. And they just need to, I think, not, like, the beautiful game stuff isn't really working at all. Like, I think they need to just go more to, and we've said this for years and years, but particularly against this Memphis team, like, they just have places that they can attack. Like, this isn't 2018 Houston we're talking about here.
Yeah. By the way, good on Taylor Jenkins for getting Melton back in the rotation for this series. I was worried he was going to end up deep six for the whole playoffs, and I thought that would have been a mistake, because he was pretty impactful in those first two games, just like he was through the regular season, and just had a brutal stretch of that Minnesota game. And sometimes coaches will overreact to that with bench guys, so I'm glad that didn't happen here.
I agree with you, and I mean, his help defense has been critical. He's had just those two or three plays at the rim that he's able to make, and some of these, you know, even Ja getting three steals, like, those add up after a while, and they clearly made Golden State uncomfortable by the end of game two.
I am a little concerned with Memphis, that Kyle Anderson's a fairly important player in the rotation right now, and I feel like as that game two went on, especially, he became less and less playable as Golden State figured out how much further they could play off him and ignore him. And I'm just wondering where that goes as this series evolves.
Yeah, I'd actually like to see them get Kyle Anderson just like into the post or mid-post isolation where he's either can shoot over the top of someone, like, because they're going to hide like a Steph or a Jordan Poole on him. And I think he, in past matchups, he's actually been able to kind of meander in the lane and score against those guys. And obviously you're not going to run your offense, Kyle Anderson, but just to get him, you know, maybe put it fouls on those guys, just get him a little bit of confidence to see the ball go through the basket, make them worry about him just a little bit. Like, that's something I would explore for, you know, maybe three or four possessions a game.
And yeah,
if but it works, then keep going to it.
The stuff where they're trying to have him pick and pop or like hold spacing in the corner, though, like that stuff is dead on arrival.
All right, we got about 10 minutes left here. Let's talk some Philly and Miami. I may be proven wrong here. I hope that I am. But Chris Haynes report that Joel Embiid was only able to look at his phone for the first time 2 days ago without suffering concussion symptoms. I'm not sure how Embiid can make it through the concussion protocol in time to play on Friday.
It would seem unlikely, right? And so who's riding in to save this team if that isn't the case? I mean, you could argue that Philadelphia should play smaller, should try, you know, just try going even smaller, faster, just junk up the game as much as they can, embrace more of an underdog strategy, try more of what, you know, Ty Lue Clippers thing, basically, because they have nothing to lose by going that direction. Certainly, you know, doing that instead of keep sending DeAndre Jordan out there seems like a good idea, right? But I still wonder, like, one of the things is to make that small lineup work, you need enough shooting, and they're just not shooting right now. And the shooters they have out there, other than, like, their best shooter is probably Niang, who is getting targeted on every single play when he's in the game, right? He's getting the Luka treatment, fouled out in 10 minutes. And they've been pretty good on Maxi. And then, like, once they get in their bench, like, Tybal's out there, they're not guarding him at all. Danny Green, they're just like, they're not, they don't They're not worried about him. If you're playing small lineups, you're probably introducing like Shake Milton. Again, that's a, like, is that really a threat? So unless James Harden turns back the clock, I just have a hard time seeing against a defense this good where Philadelphia gets enough points.
Yeah, now I think you can make the argument in game two that other than the shooting, they played well enough to win. And they have had wonderful shooting games in these playoffs. And that's, while Joel Embiid does help you get more open looks, generally if you're taking a three-pointer, it's because you're open and they have some pretty good shooters. And you mentioned Niang, like he's, Doc Rivers said that he's struggling with a knee issue right now. Like he clearly is not the panacea. They did experiment with Tobias Harris at center late in the fourth quarter. And I think I would try to go back to that some at least as well. And, but Harris is playing pretty well to me. You know, Maxey had a great game on in game two. Like Harden probably played about as good as he can play these days for a half, although he couldn't sustain it. The shots just didn't go down, and then Miami was 14 to 29 themselves. So I think ultimately, though, they just don't have like the side, like Bam is just killing them, which is a huge problem, I think, on both ends actually.
And Jimmy Butler's killing them too.
Yeah, at least he was.
He's having a great postseason.
Yeah, it's so weird sometimes, like game two, you just look down at his line like, oh wait, he had 22 points and 12 assists and he was really efficient. Like you didn't even like perceive that it was happening throughout the game sometimes.
Yeah
because he's like, not just okay, we're gonna run this pick and roll for him, and he's not spending nearly as much time on the ball as some of his other guy, to where you kind of internalize what he's doing. He's just finishing efficiently, and he's a shooting more as well, which is good for them, like enough to be a threat.
Yeah, and he's kind of awesome on defense too.
Yeah, I'm really gonna look forward to Miami versus whoever it's gonna be in the next round.
Well, especially Miami probably gets Kyle Lowry back after these 3 days off.
Yeah, one would think and hope that that's the case. That could be an issue for Philly as well. But I think Philly, you know, I would give Philly like a 40% chance of winning game three, and then I think Embiid can maybe come back for game four, and you've got at least something of a series.
Yeah, that's the best hope of something competitive happening here. One thing I've noticed with Miami, by the way, I thought they looked really good with PJ Tucker playing five, and I feel like they're just saving that. Like they keep playing Dwayne Dedman in these games, even though the minutes aren't going real well with him out there. And it's almost like they don't want to play that card until they have to. Like they don't want to maybe wear out Tucker, let's say, or they'd rather have him up top guarding Harden and use his minutes that way. But I've found it odd that they keep going back to Dedman.
Yeah, and also Bam is just not playing that many minutes either. I think they like the Tucker is a big part of their switching group. So I think the idea is that they'd love to match up Bam and Tucker's minutes a fair amount as well, so that you can just terrorize teams with this switching group at the start of games. So I understand that. I mean, they haven't been threatened much, and I think they will go Tucker at center a fair amount because Dedman, you know, I'm not sure how much he can give them. Like they'll usually try to play some zone as well. Like they've got both Dedman and Hero out there. I think part of the reason Duncan Robinson is just done now is Strus was better than him as a starter because of his defense to be part of that switching group. And then off the bench, Hero and Dedman and Robinson was just not going to work. And so that's why we're...
You could see that even in the Atlanta series. Like it was hunting season for Atlanta. It wasn't Trae Young. It was Bogdanovich. He was just wrecking those guys when they both were out there. And one of them had to guard him as the primary defender. It was the only thing that was making it a series through 3.5 games. And finally Spoelstra was just like, okay, uncle, forget this.
Yeah. So, and I think also once Lowry is back as well, and they have another kind of big defender that they can throw out there, because it seems like they don't really want to switch as much with Vincent as they would with Lowry. So that might mean that they can get some more minutes out of that Tucker at center group, because if you're going Tucker at center, then the idea is that you're switching as well. And that group at the end of the first and third quarters just may not have the personnel to do that. So I think maybe we'll see more of that once Lowry is back. And frankly, once they actually have to try.
Yeah, kind of reading the paper while they take care of Philly so far.
And Tucker can foul, like he's going to end up with five fouls every game in the playoffs. That's just what happens to him.
And he will explain to you in great detail why all five of them were not actually fouls.
Yeah, someday we'll have to do a top five players in the NBA who just have no idea when they have fouled. I've got three right now.
Okay.
Patrick Beverley and Karl-Anthony Towns.
Yes.
Tucker.
Uh-huh.
Do we, do we have to throw Jaren Jackson in there too?
I think he's definitely, I mean, he is definitely greatly puzzled every time he's called for a foul. And then you watch the replay, you're like, oh yeah, that's that's what the foul was.
Yeah. When you're like, okay, well, I think we know why you commit these fouls, because you just have no idea when you, what is a foul and when you're actually committing one. Yeah. Now I would say Draymond, I'm not going to put him up there because I think he knows when he's committed a foul, but he's just trying to maintain his reputation of being this great defender who never fouls. So he complains even when he knows he's committed the foul.
Or when he's committed a flagrant foul, let's say.
What did you think of his, that flagrant two on him, by the way?
I thought it was two flagrant ones on the same play, one with each hand. I thought if you're going to justify keeping him in the game, you could argue that it was a flagrant for the karate chop to the face and then a technical for fouling Clark after the whistle on the second one to grab him by the jersey and pull him down, right? That was the call to me that could keep him in the game, if you called it that way. But there were like two separate serious violations within 1 second of each other. It's one of the oddest things I've ever seen for somebody to do one flagrant with each hand on the same play.
Yeah, I agree. I was not nearly as against that him being thrown out, I think, as a lot of people were. But I think, like, the jersey thing, oh, I was trying to grab him and hold him up, like, or no. Well, no, first there was it was one of the explanation was, oh, my hand got caught in his jersey, and the other one was, oh, I was trying to hold him up. Well, okay, if your hand got caught in his jersey, then that wasn't intentional, but you're intentionally trying to hold him up at the same time. That didn't really make a lot of sense to me. And
yeah,
it just, like, you can't grab a guy's jersey and yank him down when he's in the air. Like, I don't recall ever really seeing that play.
No, before. No, yeah.
And he was lucky that he was able to then kind of grab him so he didn't just, like, slam his face onto the floor. But it was, yeah, I think you particularly that sort of a play, like, you just can't, that's not something that you can be allowed.
Yeah. The only thing that I'm upset about is it provided more content for his podcast than for our podcast.
Yeah, I wonder how that thing's doing. As a podcast industry veteran, I
that was your first thought?
Yeah. Well, because he had a previous podcast with Marcus Thompson that was relatively short-lived, and now he started doing it again with now that and I'm sure that he's also doing these TNT appearances as well. All right. Anything else you want to talk about here? Let's just hit a couple categories. Who's your NBA champion?
I'm still going to go Phoenix over Boston in the finals.
That would be just an absolute war.
Yes.
I think, like, Boston or Miami, to me, maybe a little bit less so Milwaukee, but Boston, Miami, I think they can slow down this Phoenix offense. Not stop them. I think Phoenix, they're going to have home court. They'll have a very good chance of winning still. But I think to actually be able to switch against Chris Paul, like, I don't know if Chris Paul going one-on-one against some of these guys, like, yeah, you could probably beat Robert Williams. That would be the one. Or Al Horford, you know, that. But this Boston defense is like an all-time. Like, they're fantastic. That would be such a good matchup. I don't know how well Boston would be able to score on them either. I mean, this Milwaukee series is kind of showing my concern about Boston, because Boston didn't play a real defense in the first round. But yeah, I'd probably say Boston and Phoenix. And God, I don't know who I would pick to win. You'd have Phoenix.
I went Phoenix in seven before the playoffs. Yeah. So I don't have any reason to deviate from that.
Yeah, I think that feels right to me. I don't know how well Paul and Booker will be able to score against this Boston defense. But I think they'll do better than KD and Kyrie did, because they actually have an offense, which those guys don't.
Yeah, they actually run stuff, and then they have secondary things they could get to.
Don't have two total non-shooters on the floor at all times.
Right. I was going to say, it could end up being an Ayton series for them.
Yeah, I think that's very possible. I think I probably would go with Phoenix. I mean, obviously, it's always, we're such prisoners of the moment here. I mean, after that game that Phoenix played yesterday, it's like they're never going to lose a single game.
Oh, of course. Again, yes.
Right? Like,
yes.
So
yes.
It's tough. And who is the MVP of the playoffs so far?
So I actually wrote about this for The Athletic, and it's going to run tomorrow morning. Chris Paul.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Giannis, Paul, and Tatum would be the three for me that are in the mix. I mean, Tatum had a great game too.
Jimmy Butler.
Himself.
Jimmy Butler's got to be in that mix. He missed one game.
They haven't played anyone though.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest knock, but he's been awesome. Like, he's done, like, he's maxed out on what he could do, right? It's just, we haven't seen him do it against the highest level opposition yet.
Yeah, and also he missed a game game, and he had a bad game one against Philly. So I think that would put him a tier below to me.
Tough crap.
I think I probably, well, it's tough competition with some of these other guys. I probably would go Tatum over Paul because his defensive contributions in the first round so massive as well. And I think Paul's been better offensively, but not by enough to counteract that. Let's see here. Any like real coaching stuff that stood out to you? I think we've talked about most of it in the course of discussing these games or these series, I should say.
There's one coaching thing that we should talk about.
The Sacramento Kings?
Yes. What the hell?
I mean, what is so weird about it to you? I can't say that anything stuck out to me, although I haven't been following that story extremely.
It just close. It feels so contrived where this is headed, like that the owner is choosing the coach, and it's just, you know, it's just waiting for it to go through a sort of normal looking process so it doesn't seem like a total sham. Like there's no chance Monty McNair's first choice or his 11th choice was Mark Jackson.
What makes you say that?
I mean, other than the fact that he worked hand in hand with Mike D'Antoni for years, right? I mean, he was traveling with the team to all the games. He was with D'Antoni every single day during that era. I don't know if people realize that, because he was the one, even though he was in the front office staff, like he was the guy who traveled with the team like through the whole year. So he was around D'Antoni all the time. Like that's a pretty tight relationship there. I who knows, maybe they got sick of each other, but I for him to be a candidate and then not go any further than that to me was a total red flag.
I will push back on this. I don't think D'Antoni is the right hire.
Okay, that's fair. The one argument I had against D'Antoni was that Alvin Gentry was running his stuff anyway, and where Sacramento has to get better is on the defensive end. So that's where you could argue.
And also, you have a young team, right? Like bringing in a 71-year-old coach for a young team. Just, I mean, I look at every coach hire as an opportunity to hire the coach who's going to be here for 10 years. Like you should be shooting for that coach, unless you're a team that's like a championship contender right now for like the next 2 years, right? Like,
what if your only goal in the entire universe is to just make the play in one time?
Yeah. Well, and that's probably why McNair would have wanted D'Antoni too, because there's reporting from Sam Amick that he could be under fire.
Oh,
right?
Totally.
If they don't make the play in or the playoffs this year, because, you know, he's had so much autonomy to reshape this roster. And the Dumar is leaving thing too. My hypothesis, although this is just totally unsupported by any actual evidence, is that the Sabonis thing was a very kind of Dumar. I mean, obviously, it was the Vivek pressure that got them there, but that was kind of a Dumars-y move.
You don't see a general manager hit a lottery pick out of the park and then trade him the next year when he's under fire. Like that literally never ever happens.
Yeah, that's true, right? Usually guys overvalue those players.
Totally. Anything. Yeah,
and who knows about McNair? Maybe we're just giving him too much credit because he's supposedly more analytical and from Houston and all that, but part of his job is to manage some of these other forces, not that anyone else has ever succeeded at that with Vivek Ranadive either. But so you think it's going to be Mark Jackson, and this is all subterfuge, and
this is all rubber stamp. I hope I am wrong about this. I think Mike Brown deserves another chance to coach in the league. Like I would be tickled if he got the job there, even if it's not the greatest, you know, place for coaching longevity or whatever historically. Like I would feel great about that if it ends up being him, but I have a feeling that's not who it's going to be.
I mean, honestly, if I were Mike Brown, I'd probably rather just continue being an assistant at Golden State.
Yeah.
Like to go in with these expectations, with this shitty ass team that doesn't really have any way of getting better, that has no way of defending. You have this Sabonis thing baked in as a defensive coach. You have to build your defense around Sabonis with no Miles Turner next to him. Like, good luck, man. The West is only getting stronger, although it seems like we say that every year. So someone's going to fall off, but still. That'd be interesting. I mean, Mark Jackson probably has deserved another chance at some point. Like, I realize he kind of sounds like a buffoon on TV, but his record with Golden State was pretty good. Like, I think he can be a good coach for a young team. Like, I'm not going to predict that it's going to go well, but he's not like an awful fit for this group necessarily with what his strengths are, like, because they're just trying to make a big improvement and make the playoffs.
Yeah,
which is kind of what he did previously. I certainly would have more respect for Mike Brown than Mark Jackson, but Mark Jackson will have assistants and stuff too. He's an emotional leader or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's probably enough here for this week. Yeah. What were you going to say?
No, I think we're good.
Excellent. All right. We'll be back probably Wednesday, I'm guessing, of next week, unless the schedule dictates Thursday. We'll talk to you all then.